the Everyday Novelist NaNoWriMo Write Through for 2020. I am your host, J. Daniel Sawyer, and I am joined by your co-host,
Kitty Nakian,
and by our resident panel of writers. We have
Tori.
And we have
Gail Carriger.
Alexis is not here tonight, alas. Hopefully we will be able to catch up with her tomorrow. How's everybody doing today?
Not too bad.
Wow, mixed reactions all around. Tori, you had the sourest face. Let's start with you.
Zero words.
Oh, no.
But it's bound to happen because we're moving within the next few days. So, c'est la vie. I had a lot of packing, and I ate McDonald's, and now I feel sick.
Oh, fun.
It was worth it.
What's your McDonald's order? Do you have a standard?
The standard is chicken nuggets.
Oh.
The 10-piece. So I did all 10 pieces, and I regretted every single one.
What do you
one.
Dip? You dip?
Barbecue. Mm-hmm. All right. What about you?
I am not a McDonald's person because I'm a West Coaster, so therefore, by birthright, it has to be In-N-Out.
Oh, I miss In-N-Out.
Me too. Yeah,
it's kind of obligatory. So, I have a weird In-N-Out. I am a hamburger, not a cheeseburger. Hamburger, extra pickle, extra toasted, animal style.
Oh, I love animal
that sounds
style.
So good.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, now I'm sad. I want In-N-Out.
How about you, Kitty? How was your day today?
Not too bad. I ended up with 5,966 words.
Holy shit. 1,200 words. That's your
Oh, you did your import, didn't
ever.
You, Kitty?
I am integrating.
You're integrating.
And it's last year's Nano that you're integrating?
Yeah, the story I wrote last year was broken at a fundamental level, and I was trying to figure out what it is, and I basically started writing from scratch, but now I've gotten far enough in that I can integrate the parts that were working and rewrite them according to the new context.
Cool. That sounds great. Like bits of conversation and stuff like that and Survivor. Yeah, that sounds cool. Neat.
Which is great because I've forgotten how to properly open a coconut, so apparently I researched that and wrote it in great detail and I'm like, okay, how do you do that? I wrote it already. Yay.
Congratulations on your word count today, Kitty. Even though it was integration, it's still a big day. Alexis has joined us at the last minute. Welcome!
It's not the last minute.
Okay,
the first 5 minutes.
Okay, there you go. Well, welcome anyway. It's good to see you. How are you doing today?
Suddenly stressed.
Oh.
I forgot that I had a life and that I'm a person.
And those are important things to remember.
Or not.
My brain rewinded to last year when I didn't have any obligations over the weekend and I didn't do anything.
Oops. Oh, no. Did you get any writing done today?
No.
Oh, well. Tomorrow is another day.
Yeah.
I didn't either. It's okay.
Tori was packing all day. She's moving, next week.
Next week.
I have a much worse excuse.
Things in life pull you away sometimes, and the important thing is to roll with it and get back on the horse the next day.
True.
All right, so Gail, how about you? How was your day today?
It was pretty good. 78100.
1,126.
Yeah, yeah. I realized I was missing a segment, so this is the very end of the book. So, I like to have kind of conclusionary endings. I like to leave my readers feeling very satisfied. That's kind of part of my thing. And I realized that my main character has kind of been hiding this relationship this whole time, and his friends feel really betrayed, and his friends have been like a major part of the whole book, and so he has to talk about it with them. And I had left that out because I was like, oh, because I resolved the romantic thread and the magical thread and all that sort of stuff and what's going on. But I was like, oh, he can't, that's not how I write. I write with found family as the friendship group. And so I really need, especially in a collegiate setting, I really need to address the betrayal that they feel and whether it's valid and how he's going to cope with it. And so that means they have to have
fallout.
A whole conversation. Yeah. They have to have a whole fallout conversation.
Yep.
And
I've always enjoyed your denouements. They're always really meaty. You don't tend to leave things just hanging right write at resolution.
No, I like writing endings. I'm one of those authors who really loves to write the end of things. And because it's like, because I like tying everything up in nice, neat little bows. Mm. So I've always enjoyed, when I'm writing longer series. Who would have thought? When I'm writing longer series, I've always enjoyed writing the last book in a series really, really well. And I've actually have a lot of fans that are like, well, we want more from the series. And I'm like, no, I ended it. And it's very satisfying. And I'm not going to write with those characters again because I'm so proud of my last book. Like, my last book is almost always my favorite book in any given series.
That explains why you bitched so much about getting the extra two books for the Soulless series, because Blameless, you tied up so wonderfully.
I did tie a lot up in Blameless, but I didn't know I was going to get more books. But then I scattered again. I'd scattered so much in Changeless that like there were more threads for me to pick up. But Timeless is my favorite in that series because it's the last one, and I knew it was going to be the last one, and it's very satisfying to me. I also think it's the funniest book I've ever written, Timeless. It's my favorite humor book.
Well, I have a special place in my heart for Blameless because I show up in it.
Yes, you do. That's very true. That's very, very true. Dan was writing me into one of his books, so I wrote Dan into one of my books at the same time, and he's in Blameless.
Fitting revenge.
It is. It's very true. So all in all, good, because I did that scene, and that is mostly a conversation scene between multiple characters. And now is the point in the book where I start to worry about the things I've done wrong. So I'm a little concerned that I have too many characters out the gate because it's an ensemble piece with the friendship group and stuff. But, like, that feels more honest, the collegiate experience. So I'm kind of dithering over stuff. But how about you, Dan? How did your writing day go today?
I had less time to write than I expected because I also was cruelly interrupted by family. Damn them. But I did have at least some time to get through one of the scenes I have been dreading, which is the scene where everybody begins to find out pieces of what everybody else knows.
Aha!
And resulted
the consolidation scene.
Yeah, it's one of a few that's going to be coming up, but it's the first major consolidation scene that results in that time-tested trope of horror fiction. We must all split up and explore the ship.
You beat that dead trope. Beat it.
I did, and I found a way to do it that it's not stupid.
Ooh, that is very exciting.
The guy who's organizing the search is someone with experience in foreign theaters of warfare, and one of the other people is a horror movie buff. And so he's objecting that this is where everything goes wrong in horror films.
I freaking love lamp lighting. It is one or however you want to...
Lampshading.
Lampshading, yeah. Or however you want to call it. Which is when the author calls attention via character, usually, to a trope that they are, like... So I just did exactly the same thing, because I have this, like, grand romantic gesture where the main character literally steps off a cliff to save the other one, and thereby proving his love, but also outing them to the entire campus, because everyone's watching. And I was like, this is so crazy drama romance. Like, this is so... this is such a teen movie all of a sudden. And so in the next scene, I have one of the mages make a ballad song for them about it.
Oh,
and the whole campus just starts like singing it at him anytime he walks into like a tent or anything. So he now has a theme song about his overdramatic love gesture. Makes me really happy.
That's
and they only
perfect.
Do it to him because his love interest is kind of an arrogant asshole. So he's the only one who would take it.
Nice. But yeah, I had a lot of fun backing my characters into a situation where literally the only thing they could do in order to cope
is
with what's
the trope.
Going on is to split up.
Nice.
And then to have them argue about it.
That is so good. It is such a fun, like, tool because it's basically the writer is saying to the audience, look, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I know what I'm doing here, and I know it's been done before, but let's mock it or talk about it and have the characters do that. I love that kind of thing. It's so much fun to do.
Now I have to decide how soon I want the rest of the dead bodies to start to fall.
Woo! Or float, depending on your gravity situation.
Float, yeah. Well, yeah, some of them will be floating, some of them will be falling, but because there's sections under spin, but... the there's two or three more big reveals that have to come out, and I'm trying to figure out if I want everybody to be around for those or if I can afford to have some of them dead for that.
Ooh.
So, and what which way will ramp the suspense up more?
So. Oh, exciting. Yeah, so you're rounding you're coming into the slide for home as well.
Yeah,
I can tell by the tone of your voice.
Yeah, I think I may that surmounting this scene may have just pushed me past the 2/3 mark.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's exciting.
We shall see.
Yeah, yeah. I have to go back and write that scene that I set up for myself to write today tomorrow because I wrote this other one instead. But the theme song was too much fun to. To pick up and play with.
I am discovering that the further I get into my career, the more I'm finding opportunities to integrate like fictitious song lyrics and other stuff like that. And I'm loving it.
Oh, I feel you, Dad. The last San Andreas book that I wrote, every single chapter title was a famous country western song. Title rewritten with werewolves or shapeshifters in mind. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, you know, howl with me instead of walk with me or you know, that kind of thing. And I could not have had more fun with that really dumb premise. Nice. But I love titles.
I do too. And I'm going to do every chapter title in this book is going to be like a super pulpy one, like The Peril of the Perseids. And
like that. That sounds like so much fun.
I know. In the book I wrote for Nano last year, there's a sequence where the main character and his kind of becoming his girlfriend are at a blues club, and they fall in love, or they admit that they've fallen in love during this song, and so I've got the lyrics of the song in there, and, you know, it's something I just completely made up because it fits the moment. But now yes. I'm like, now I got to write music for it. And in this one, the unexpected death, the one we've had so far, sends one of the characters into a spiral of depression where she's remembering super depressing song lyrics that are like utterly nihilistic and about the loneliness of the universe.
I think this might be my personal choice for the funniest thing I ever wrote, which is a bunch of werewolves at a country music concert where there's a werewolf country music singer, and she is gonna like spectacularly change and shift form, and all of her like tragic country western songs are all about like humans falling in love with werewolves and how it can never work out, and she has this famous nice. Kind of achy breaky heart sort of song which the chorus is basically fangs 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 in the evening light, kind of, it's just so bad. And, of course, it's her most famous song, so she's doing it at the encore. The werewolves are respectively, like, trying to control the crowd and, like, losing their minds over how horrible this whole experience is. And they're all on calm, so the lyrics are going on, and then the calm conversation is going on. I think it's so funny. Like fun. I cried when I was first writing it. But it was one of those that I read out loud for my... one of my writing groups when I was on a retreat. And so I sang it badly because I can't sing. turns out many of the other writers actually are singers. And one of them is from the South and actually had done competitive voice talent shows and stuff. She decided to just make up a version of that song and then sang it at me and down the hallways for the rest of the retreat. So, yeah. Like, you know. Nice.
So your current scene is, like, echoing that.
Yes. Yeah. I was delighted by it because she has a great voice. But it was really funny. You'd open the door and she'd be like, fangs, fangs, fangs. And I'm like, oh, thanks, darling. It's very funny.
Oh, yeah. Well, between the song in Down from 10, the one in Wolf of Venus, and the one in this one, I figure I only need to write another 10 books before I've got enough to make an album.
Well, Mercedes Lackey did that, right? Like,
she did. Yeah. I didn't know that. I knew that Julia Eklar had done that. Her album, Divine Intervention, was amazing.
Okay, so Mercedes doesn't sing herself, I don't think, but she puts a lot of, like, in the Herods of Valdemar and, like, the Valdemar series in general, she has a lot of songs. And I think she... got some Filkers or something to like write music for it and put a whole thing. I think you can find them on YouTube of all places.
Cool.
But at least some of them. But yeah, nice. I think it's cool when writers do that kind of thing.
Me too. I like anyone who does more than one art form.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
It cross-fertilizes in wonderful ways.
Yeah, it's really fun. Fun to see.
Yeah. Anyone else got another topic, or should we go to the forums?
Let's go to the forum. That is an interesting question.
Okay, here we go. Question from JR. Thoughts on handling sensitive topics? As an example, my main character is a polygamist. I want to treat his life choices with respect without upsetting the biases of modern readers. This is a more general question, so take it from any angle that fits your works in progress.
Don't be scared of offending people, because it's not possible to not.
There's that.
Unless if you just hermit, and then even still.
Being a hermit is a fairly offensive life choice, so.
What?
It's very appealing,
You're
though.
You're literally minimizing the amount of offensive things you could possibly say to anyone.
I don't know. I've known some super social extroverts who find hermitage and introversion in general deeply offensive. So,
See, it's not possible.
Yeah, I tend to think you're right about that. I don't generally worry about it. In fact, I kind of go out of my way to offend my readers. I've got a rationale for this. I figure that if I don't have something in my books that will offends me, then I'm running too much of a risk of preaching instead of doing art.
Or being boring.
So I try very hard to put something in my books that I find either offensive or distasteful or often intellectually uncongenial. Because I find it gives me a remove from the story. So I don't identify so closely with the characters that I start writing author avatars all the time.
Do you have an example?
There's some trivial examples, like in Hadrian's Flight, the main character loves eggs, and I think that is just the most appalling possible thing you could do to a chicken is to eat it before it's finished ripening.
Can I say for the record that egg is my favorite food? But go on, Dan.
I know.
I'm deeply offended.
Scotch egg. And scotch eggs, too. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Scotch eggs.
I love scotch eggs.
Never had one of life's great joys, the protein ball.
Terrible thing to do to a chicken.
Delicious.
But in more substantive ways, for example, in Down from 10, the character whom I have the least affection for is the one who winds up solving the mystery before everyone else, and being right about many of the things he advances in a way, and he advances them in a way that pisses everyone else off. But I do that a lot. I try very hard to make my characters their own people and not just avatars of me or caricatures of things I want to tear down. So if I've got a character that's an interlocutor that I personally want to argue against, I will make sure that they have points and positions, attitudes, or qualities that are unassailably correct, so that it's not just me preaching at the audience and the audience has the room to work things out for themselves.
This is I struggle with this question, I have to say. Because there are some hard and fast rules, which is that what you put into your book, your readers, at least some of them, will assume is your opinion. Whether it's the bad guy or the good guy or whatever, they're going to assume that that's your opinion. And so if you are writing a complicated story with complicated villains, the villains are also going to be associated with you. And their feelings and opinions, etc. And therefore, readers are always going to willfully misconstrue you. Or maybe unwillfully, I don't know, maybe it's...
Well, sometimes both. Some people do just look for reasons to be
Yeah, some people
off.
Look for reasons to hate you, especially if you're a popular author. Mm-hmm. So that is a problem. Also, we authors make unintentional mistakes all the time in terms of, like, residual baggage from our upbringings or stations in life or what have you. So that is also going to cause problems, and it's there in black and white for the rest of your life, the mistakes that you've made. So I worry about it. Like, all the time, constantly. And it totally affects my writing. There are things I have chosen never to write again because somebody on the internet got really mad at me about it. And I was like, oh, I don't ever want to deal with that, period. So I don't stick X kind of representation in my book anymore because I don't want to deal with it, that kind of thing. So, you know, and there are series that I have stopped writing and characters that I no longer put into books because of that sort of thing. So, and perhaps I should get off the internet and not interact with people.
I would love that just because I liked those things you stopped doing. So, but
yeah but that's the choice I make. Because I have plenty of other stories I can tell. So I can pick up and write something else.
And then there's a personality difference showing up here. I am fundamentally disagreeable. I thrive on conflict. I really enjoy going toe-to-toe with people I think are absolute batshit fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And sometimes finding out that even if they're batshit fucking crazy, I was wrong. And I love that kind of thing. And I also do have that dark corner of my soul where I sort of glory it over, you know, dance in the corpses of my enemies when I didn't turn out to be wrong. But from the time I was born, I mean, really, literally, like the night I was brought home, my parents tell stories about me trying to bully them into leaving the lights on when I was 6 hours old. I just came this way from the factory. And so because of that, my values when it comes to offending readers or offending groups in my books or ideologies or anything like that has much more to do with my own personal ethics about the value of the individual person and whatnot than it does about the fashions of the current cultural climate. So as long as I am satisfied that I have done right according to my value system, I'm happy to be burned alive for it.
Yeah, I am conflict avoiding with, especially with strangers, which is everybody who is not a friend, as far as I'm concerned, mm-hmm. like not a personal friend. Sorry to all my readers out there. So that's part of it. I'm also a female, and I don't want to get doxxed. So there are other mm-hmm. reasons that I, you know, I genuinely fear for my safety in the days of the internet and being a semi-public mm-hmm. figure. So I have
that's not just
lots
a female. I worry about that too. And I take steps. I've been frequenting blogs for sex workers and whatnot about privacy things and implementing stuff like that ever since I became a semi-public figure because I have been stalked. And it's no fun.
No, really not. So there are, you know, there are those sorts of things to consider, and I just would rather not include that sort of thing in my mm-hmm. books at all, so I just don't.
But don't you run into people that get mad at you for excluding things from your book?
Knowing that people are going to get mad at me no matter what is, like, part of the survival tactic, but I do blog posts that are like, okay, so I don't have representation for this, here's a bunch of authors who do. So go pick at their stuff. Like, I don't have time to write representation of every single thing into my books, even though I try to be as inclusive as possible. And honest to goodness, in order to do some of these things justice, because it's so much not my life experience, the amount of research that would go into doing it in order to write a character like that is just, mm-hmm. I don't have time. I'm sorry, I don't have time. If you want the next, like, it's the age-old, like, argument. Either you want the next book from the author, or you want the next book that you think that author should write, which would take them 8 times as long. In which case, you should be writing it.
Like, that's true.
Why am I supposed to write that book? You should write that book. Right.
But you touched on something there that is really important from an artistic point of view that doesn't just reflect our underlying differences of approach to the world. That's worth highlighting, I think. The research question. If you're going to be, you know, it's one thing to fake a city or to fake an area of engineering that you know that your readers aren't going to know anything about. But if you're going to be doing characters and having them motivated and having them come from a different subculture than you do, the verisimilitude of the character, the art demands that you do as good a job as you possibly can. And that limits anyone's available bandwidth if you buy into that principle. So, you know, you will write characters who you either can access because you've known characters like that all your life, or who you can access because you've gotten to know some people who have that background, or because you got interested in something else that led you down a rabbit trail that got you familiar with a culture that you hadn't run into before.
Yeah. And I will write characters for whom I have sensitivity readers, too. Like, I have a little, like, kind of cadre of sensitivity readers now. And even getting a sensitivity reader means that they can only read for sensitivity to their identity. And, you know, inevitably someone will write me and be like, like, you know, like I did Fifth Gender and I had, I think, like 5 trans readers sensitivity read for Fifth Gender and I still got angry and an angry message from someone who felt that their particular version of that identity had not been represented properly by my alien with tentacle hair. So like, like that's, but that is the ultimate rule is like, and this, for as far as I'm concerned, it plays in the 10% rule, which is no matter what you do, you offend 10% of your readers with something. And if you don't have that many readers, then that's not that many readers. But if you have 1 million readers, then, you know, you're pissing off 10,000 readers. So like, you know, it and that's like, that's the trade you make for making your work public. If you don't want to piss anybody off, you don't make your work public.
And the other side of that is if you write entirely towards the positive prejudices of sensitivity readers or people who may be sensitive to what you're writing, you really do run the risk of writing a complete stereotype that can rob the character of freshness and vitality and the individuality that actually makes for good representation. What I did with the Suave Rob books is Rob is absolutely not the representative of all trans people in the world. Rob is the representative of Rob. I had a couple of people who I knew very well who I pulled from to make Rob, and I know that he's a good, solid character. And if he offends someone, well, he's also designed to offend conservatives and just about everybody else under the sun, so, you know, everybody's in the same basket. Artistically, it has a lot to do, I think, with your ethics around how you construct a good character and what level of research you're willing to do to go certain places.
There are tropes and archetypes that I feel like it's important to, like, do think about in terms of representation. For example, tokenism or killing your gays or, you know, there are certain things that are damaging that I think, generally speaking, if you're going or interested in becoming a popular author, you should kind of, like, keep... It's good to know the pitfalls.
It's good to know the pitfalls because if you like to dance near them, like I do, you want to make sure that you don't dance near them unintentionally.
Exactly. So, you know, there are some things that I'm like, yeah, I keep those things in mind just sort of instinctively, I hope. But you know, I also don't know all of the pitfalls, and, you know, and I...
No, and you can't.
And you can't be that researched, and so, like, I have to... add. Being a writer is a courageous choice and for anybody, and you, one of the parts of that courage is knowing that you are gonna hit up pitfalls in some arena, whether it's thematically or message wise, whether it's archetypes or tropes, whether it's representation. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the journey of being a writer is knowing that you're probably gonna upset somebody. In fact, you will definitely upset somebody. And
if you're just doing your job, you certainly will.
Just gonna hope you're upsetting the right contingent to upset. Yep.
You're upsetting people in the right way, the way that you intend to upset them.
Or the less violent people.
Yeah.
Well, that's hard, because there's violent people in every subculture.
I mean, or
even pacifists, oh my god.
Someone's going to show up on your doorstep and scream at you about your shoe choices. You know, like, you don't know what's going to happen.
It's true.
I'm going to offend somebody with my lipstick color choices, or the fact that I like vintage attire has pissed people off, and I'm just like...
Or eggs!
Yeah.
Oh my god, Gail! Eggs!
Yes. Heaven forfend I criticize, you know, some form of food, like the cake donut. Like, I don't know, people, but I don't like cake donuts. I'm what? Sorry. I think you should eat cake.
Is that cake in a donut shape deep fried?
No, they're the non-raised donuts.
They're the non-raised donuts, not glazed donuts, the cake donuts. You know, they look like old-fashioned. Sometimes they think, they disguise themselves as French crullers, but they're not. They are sometimes called the old-fashioned donut, and I think if you're going to make something out of cake, that you should make a cake, not a donut. That is all. And how many angry emails am I going to get about that? Because, you know, it's to a certain extent, this is a failure of fandom, too. I hate to say it. Is the, like, don't yuck your yum, sure. Like, that's a good rule of thumb as a general rule. But just because I don't like something doesn't mean I'm upset that you like it. Like,
yeah, what happens? The technical term for what goes on is called a parasocial relationship around with a cult figure. Mm. A parasocial relationship is what you develop with someone who you don't know, but whose work you read, whose music you listen to, whose acting you watch. Part of you bonds with the image of that person that has formed itself in your head. And then when you find out that they're not the kind of person you hoped they were, or they have opinions you don't approve of, or if they come out with a piece of art that you just don't like, you feel personally betrayed, when of course it has nothing to do with you. But an unfortunate aspect of fandom, and of most fandoms, is that people congregate around these artworks that they identify with. And so there's always, even in the more level-headed fandoms, there's always at least a low level of a minor deification of the artists. And artists are good, as a rule, at one thing, and that's making the artwork that you love. That doesn't have anything to do with the rest of their character. They may be good people or bad people. They may be responsible or irresponsible. They may eat eggs. or they may have a rational attitude towards chicken. Or they may like cake donuts, when you know that that's blasphemy.
And they may write in Mickey Mouse.
And they may write in Mickey Mouse for president. But the problem with fandoms is, because the group identity gets built around the artwork, the parasocial relationship gets sort of gets solidified. Where on your own, any individual fan who's not involved in a fandom can deal with, oh, that my favorite movie that the one of the actors just got Me Too'd. Well, I'm not going to let him steal the movie from me. Or it's a big enough deal to me that I'm going to let him steal the movie from me and I'm not going to support him anymore. As an individual choice, that's one thing. But when the fandom gets together, the group mind works. And there's always, in any fandom, there's the contingent that are jealous of the success of the deified figure. And they're waiting for a reason to kick them off the pedestal, because they get brownie points socially and they sort of become a leader. So there's all sorts of toxic dynamics that can emerge in fandom, especially when it's found family for people among people who do not have a solid grounding in another found family. And those are really important groups, but they also have dangers for the artists around whose work they congregate.
I spend a lot of time saying, please don't make demigods out of authors. Please don't make them. And it's kind of a hope, including me.
Yeah.
Like, it's like mm-hmm. a kind of a hopeless chant, but I say it a lot.
I do too. But yeah, it is a hopeless chant.
So this always happens. And we're like circling in on like the great debate over separating the artist from art and cancel culture and all that sort of thing, which I think we probably should not do. But the answer to the question on how, like, the very open-ended question that we started this with on, like, how to write sensitive subjects, essentially, is, like, do as much research as you can and sally forth in the direction of greatest courage, knowing that you're going to upset people, because you're going to upset people. We all upset people with our existence as people.
Do your absolute best and expect to be pilloried for it.
Yeah, sorry. Try not to let it paralyze you into not writing.
Yes. Anyone else have opinions, thoughts, or anything else?
My thought is that how you approach a topic depends a lot on whether it's a real world setting that you're writing, or a historical or fictional. Because if it's real world or historical, then the characters involved should encounter some of the same types of problems that they would have encountered in the real world and in the past. You can't write people being 100% accepted for a life choice or an identity that could get them killed in a real world setting. So there should be dynamics that are relevant to their situation, even if it's in the background, even if it's like a background fear and not something that you see on the page. If you're in a fictional setting and the wider society accepts that situation, then you also have to spin out what a society would look like that accepts that.
And that goes right to the heart of the question with the question of the main character with a polygamous family arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
If that's unusual in that world, well, that's going to raise some eyebrows and maybe cause some problems. And if it's not unusual in that world, what does that imply for the structure of the society that he's in?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And similarly, and, you know, this again is another, like, longer discussion, I suspect. If you're writing a fantasy world with certain kinds of magic, in much in the way that we talked about the fact that if you have mages wielding projectile magic, then you have star-shaped castle structures and that sort of thing. Like, the real world responds. There's a similarly, like, technological advancements or tweaks in fantasy and fantasy historical settings or far future settings has cultural implications and cultural repercussions. So, think one of the great critiques, and I think it's a valid critique on a lot of, like, the 50s and 60s sci-fi, hard sci-fi authors, is they advance technology but do not change culture in any way. And so you get these, like, 50s housewives in space kind of dealy bobs. But this is the fun of being an author as well, is like thinking about how your world building and how your magical system and how your far future technology impacts your culture is also very interesting and your setting.
I did an episode about this a few years ago, which we'll link to in the show notes, called Nuclear Storytelling Options, where I talk about the kinds of technological changes that if you change that one thing, it changes the whole world. Nuclear weapons with relations to warfare, the birth control pill with relationship to feminism and women's rights and things like that. You introduce a certain kind of technology and the whole universe reorganizes around it because it fundamentally destabilizes the cultural trade-offs that were baked into the system before it came
in. I did it in the Parasolverse with a cultural insert. So I made immortal monsters real and then examined how that would impact society, including sexual orientations and representations, but also the physicality of society in terms of technological evolution and stuff. But that all came from a social science perspective, because that's what interests me the most. So how does the insert of this one conceit change the world around it? And it's, you know, like, at its heart, almost all science fiction and fantasy in particular is a sort of, like, micro-exploration of some kind of twist of reality in terms of conceptualization. And so, you know, that's the fun.
Yeah, and if you want to learn how to do that, looking at history is a really good way to do it. I mean, one of my favorite, and not favorite as in I'm happy about it, but as in the consequence that I find most interesting, is that the largest consequence of the printing press was 500 years of war.
Wasn't there also something about religion and, capitalizing
So when the printing press came in, suddenly everybody could publish their opinions about religion. That caused the fracture in the religious order that had obtained since the Roman Empire in Europe. And that allowed each prince to set up their own pet Protestant sect. And so they could disguise their attempts to gain control over over land for geopolitical reasons as wars of religion and get everyone to buy into it. And so what had been an uneasy and slowly shifting and occasionally tumultuous geopolitical situation in Europe became 30 years war, 40 years war every century until about World War II.
Oh, I was thinking of something completely different. I was thinking about how they had to have priests write individual
indulgences. Yeah, that was one of the things that first got criticized. It was also one of the first things that got printed.
Big mass thing.
Yep. Unforeseen consequences.
Although, watch out for technological determinism, says the archaeologist on the sidelines. Glaring suspiciously at Jared Diamond and the other historians of his ilk. But that's a whole other. That really is a different podcast.
Yeah, that's we've got to do a long conversation about that sometime.
Dan, you used to have a very old podcast where we talked about such things, but it is now defunct. So we can't.
Oh, we're what?
We can't talk about
the polyschismatic reference.
That
I'll tell you what, I'm bringing it back.
I will believe it when I hear it.
I'm going to be starting a new podcast next year around my autodidact book, and so I'm going to be bringing on people who are self-taught or who have extended their academic education on their own through great personal curiosity to talk about the things they have learned and thought. So maybe we'll have to do it on that podcast.
That's exciting.
And on that note, we are now running long, so
we are. We ought to cool it.
Yes.
All right, well, thank you, everybody. It was loads of fun today.
Good luck with the writing.
And you too, you too. Good luck. Hope you get to finish tomorrow.
I have a feeling I'll actually get a good
That's a good feeling.
I think I've found a little routine that I really
like.
That's
excellent.
Very good.
We'll talk about it tomorrow.
Indeed.
Good night, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.